Subcommittee for Wednesday, April 6, 2005, a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, Oregon Youth Authority. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bob Jester to come up and Ms. Pam Patton. Please go forward and just tell us how you would like to proceed.
Madam Chair, Ms. Patton is en route, is not here yet, so we would propose to begin with our presentation for today with your permission.
Very good. And let me explain what's happening with the committee. We will be without a quorum all afternoon. I do expect Senator Devlin to arrive shortly. Senator Winters is still doing part-time days. The House members, we're experiencing a bump in the road around our Ways and Means process. And so I don't know that we will actually see House members physically present, but I know that they will be monitoring the proceedings. So please keep that in mind as you go forward.
Thank you. I understand that Ms. Patton is here.
Okay. And we're going to give her time to breathe and exhale.
And while she is doing that, Madam Chair, in August of 2004, during a regular meeting of the OIA advisory group, of which Ms. Patton is a member, I asked her if she would take the lead responsibility in pulling together a group to address the unique needs of young women in the juvenile justice system. And Ms. Patton graciously agreed to do that. And that group has been meeting since August of 2004. And Pam is with us today. And I thought what we would do is go over the findings and recommendations of a draft report that that committee has put together. And then I believe that the plan is to give copies of that to members in draft form.
Well, it's part of the report.
Thank you.
So if you don't have the report, I bought extra copies.
Please go forward.
For the record, my name is Pam Patton, and I will go over the recommendations that came from the committee. Before I start the recommendations, I do want to finish some of the issues that led us to these recommendations just very briefly so that you can see where they came from.
We have about 45 minutes for this first section of the hearing before we move into agency presentations, which will kind of give you a feel for it.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I mentioned yesterday that part of the findings were that the young women's units at Hillcrest, since they had gone from 100 to 60 to 45 or 50 girls or young women at Hillcrest, is that they went from 4 units to 2 units. And one of those units is for violent offenders, most of whom are Department of Correction young women, meaning that the second of the 2 units has most of the young women that are going in and out of the system. The other issue with the process that happened producing really the Hillcrest becoming equivalent to a gatekeeper of receiving and releasing girls before they had completed programs or were prepared to be transitioned to the Corvallis House Young Women's Transition Program or for the county, we ended up with many young women in both the Corvallis House and in the communities running away. And obviously that isn't what we want for the young women. Additionally, there are two other issues that came up, and that was it's very hard to provide the gender-specific programming for young women at Hillcrest because of the fact that there aren't the numbers. So where we used to have whole units of specialized treatment approaches, alcohol and drugs, sex offender, trauma issues of young women, now it is much more difficult to do that, plus the fact that the turnover is so great, so they're not completing the programs. The other difficulty is maintaining a stable, planful transition period for the young women. Even with a shorter stay at Hillcrest, what we're hearing from the Corvallis House program is that if they can have the time to do a planful transition with the young women so that they're meeting with them several times over weeks before they transition and getting them prepared, they have much more likelihood of being successful with the young women than if they're just saying, we need to get them out of here and transitioning them so quick. That's when they end up running. The other issue that has occurred with the decrease in the number of young women is with the disproportionate number of young women to young men, the issue of sexual harassment and re-traumatization of the young women by the young men residing within close proximity has dramatically increased, and that's one of the reasons that you will hear some of our recommendations. It really distracts young women from benefiting from treatment and making progress in their programming. And you can see from the data that the young women that are at Hillcrest, Corvallis House, and in the community have a high percentage of experiences with abuse and neglect and also with alcohol and drug use, which leads me to the next issue, which is being able to really stabilize girls in the alcohol and drug program that happens at Hillcrest. That's a very serious problem for them. Methamphetamines is dramatically increased for the number of young women coming in, and it's we're not really able to get them stabilized in treatment before they're returned to the community. The other issue which you heard about yesterday is the loss of the shelter beds in the community. Therefore, a significant service within the continuum was lost, not just for girls, but for boys also, but it's really obviously it's affected the continuum for young women and being able to temporarily stabilize them and do a very good assessment for them before they move on to the next level of treatment. So that leads us to the recommendations, and our first recommendation I managed to bring in my old copy, which has slightly different language, so let me... do you have one of the new ones? No, I brought a bunch of new ones. Never mind. There. Thank you. Yeah, there's a bunch of new ones right there. The first recommendation has to do with system-wide. And that is that the Oregon Youth Authority should provide a continuum of services and programs for young women that are gender-specific and based on evidence and best practices. That these services and programs must allow young women to fully complete their programs based on the case plan that has been developed for them. As we've talked about, there is not really a continuum now, and the girls are not completing their case plans, and they're being interrupted and transitioned early and inappropriately, and it's leading to them either running away, coming back in with a revocation, or that they're in the system and not being treated appropriately in the communities, and they're going to end up in a potentially very dangerous and unhealthy life situation. So we really feel like we need that full continuum, that the services that the girls are getting should be gender-specific, and we know how to do that. We know that that it works effectively, and we've actively been working towards doing that with the Corvallis House program and then also with Hillcrest. That continuum would be gender-specific and appropriate at all levels of the continuum, and we would start with the supervision, parole, probation, then shelter care, foster care or proctor care, residential treatment in the community, and the next one is one that we're adding, which we currently do not have, and that's a 45 to 90-day secure drug and alcohol and mental health stabilization program to be decided whether that should be located at a OIA youth correctional facility or secure community-based program. That close custody services will be gender-specific, and that also will include transition services. The Corvallis House was a program added for young women. Do we remember what year that was, Bob? About 4 or 5 years ago.
I believe it was 99.
And that was because there was no transition program for young women, and there was 4 or 5 for the boys. And that was one of the first directions that we made in trying to get a continuum of gender-specific program for young women in OIA. The second... Do you want to start?
Before you go to close custody, what would be the determining factors in the four selecting either the OIA location or secure community-based program location for the 45, 90-day secure alcohol, drug, mental health?
My belief that would come out of the fourth recommendation, which we're asking that an interim committee establish what's the best place for that to happen.
All right. I'll wait till you get there.
Then in this system-wide is really looking at the OIA system even broader than, including community programs that we're talking about and looking at, even though there is no authority within this committee to talk about juvenile departments, they've been committed to be involved with this, and we see how important it is to include the full continuum, especially with the issues of mental health and alcohol and drug issues that young women have, that we also include mental health and alcohol and drug. Then in close custody, to provide a full range of close custody programming in a single facility that is single gender, so that young women have access to full range of programs specific to their risk and need and individual issues. This is an area that I feel very strongly about, and the committee has agreed with, and that is that we need to be catching up in Oregon with what many of the states that are doing better and more effective treatment with young women are, and that's provide them with a single facility for young women that is not co-ed, and that we also ensure that those programs are gender-specific and evidence-based practices happening. For both designing of a single facility and for females and for ensuring that it's gender-specific, we would utilize national and or local experts to assist the agency in doing that process. I'm totally committed to helping OIA in any way I can in doing that. We also have resources nationally we can get those sometimes free through the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to get consultants to come in to help with the planning and designing of a program for a single facility for all females. The third one is in the communities. We believe that in order to have a continuum, we need to reinstate shelter care services for young women. We need to add a 45 to 90-day secure drug and alcohol and mental health stabilization program, and like we mentioned before, located either at OIA facilities or in a facility in the community, and that would be determined by the interim work group and by looking at what's the best way we can provide those services. This addition to the continuum came as a result of a lot of discussion and surveying both field services in OIA and the Juvenile Department Directors Association about what are the problems that are occurring now that we have decreased the number of young women that are in close custody. And the issue that comes up all the time is we can't stabilize them, they run. If we can't stabilize them, they end up on waiting lists and they'll run while they're waiting, so to speak. So we're hoping that because we know that the major issues that young women come in with are mental health and alcohol and drug, that we could establish a stabilization program where we could get the young women to a place where they could be successful in the community. I think that one of the things about a continuum is that you need to be responding to what the young woman needs. So it's not a one-way continuum out. It's one back and forth based on what young women need. And as we all know, in alcohol and drug addictions, that those issues are not resolved in 3 months or 6 months. And they end up back in situations where they're in environments that get them back into their addictive behaviors and sometimes their criminal behavior. So we need to be able to move young women back and forth based on what their need is. The other thing we need to do is to provide adequate foster care and or proctor care and residential treatment for young women. We have wait lists for young women to get into all these levels of services. And especially now with decreased numbers in the facilities, we have had a history in Oregon where we have sometimes put young women in OIA facilities for their safety before the public safety, because we haven't taken care of them early enough. So they get to the point where the only way we can protect them from harming themselves by the involvement with the people that they're involved with the drugs that they're involved with the sometimes the criminal behaviors they're involved with, is to lock them up, even though they're not a public safety risk. So we really need to be able to stabilize them and put them in the least restrictive environment we can, but provide them with the support and services that they need in order to become healthy and contributing young women. We also want to work with the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association to address appropriate services for young women in communities short of the Oregon Youth Authority commitments. The information that we've gotten from the Juvenile Directors Association tells us that depending on the county you're in is how capable different juvenile departments are responding to the needs of young women. Some of them are pretty bleak. Some of them, like the larger counties, Lane County, Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, are more able to build on systems and staffings that they've had before. But for some of the rural counties, I know you heard yesterday from Molly that, like in Pendleton area, they have in Wallawa area, they have tried to set up some gender-specific programs, but it's really limited in what that they can do in the rural areas. A lot of them had established some prevention-level programs for young women with their juvenile crime prevention dollars and with their youth investment dollars from the Commission on Children and Families, but when both of those have been cut over the last two sessions, and I know because I do consulting on their gender-specific services throughout the state, most of those programs are gone. When they had to cut programs, they ended up cutting programs that were for the young women, mostly because they really had to focus on the higher-risk options of boys. So we definitely want to work with the juvenile departments because they play a very important role in providing the services for young women and supporting keeping them out of the Oregon Youth Authority. The fourth recommendation is really...
Before you go there, you talked about existing wait lists. Is there a document or would one need to be created that captures what these wait lists look like?
Actually, it's a really difficult thing to do because and this has been an issue that we've had for years and years and years, is that we can give you the number of beds that are available for young women, and beds are contracted out by either being for males, females, or either. So on the either ones, you can't confirm whether they're filled for a girl or a boy. Then the other issue that happens is that waitlists occur for like Rosemont, because it's a secure residential program, but they're because the parole or probation field staff have to place these girls, then they will send out a referral to multiple agencies to see where they can get the young women in. So one, there could be a wait list, could be a duplicate because there's more than this one person, one young woman is on more than one wait list. Or the other issue is that if they know they're full and they're not going to get a young woman in, then they just don't refer them, and so they're not on anyone's wait list. So the reason that we know that there's wait lists is because we've talked to some of the providers that they're generally full, and we've also talked with the parole folks, and that they know that not to refer because the program doesn't have any openings.
But there's not a concrete information that we can look to.
Well,
there's also this, for example, today, Wednesday, April 6, 2005, the wait list in the state of Oregon for girls who could benefit from the services as we've been describing them and defining them, that wait list looks like this. There's no way that we can capture that information.
Is there, Bob? I don't know. You have that.
Madam Chair, there is not a single source existing today that would provide you that information. With the movement into the individual risk need assessment of all youth in the juvenile justice system and then a corresponding individual case plan, I believe that that is something that in the near future would not be difficult to achieve. The unmet parts of a case plan due to a lack of resource. And that might be a charge for the interim group to look at, how to create such a list and be able to report on that.
Yes. Again, if we're going to refer to existing wait list, existing need, we need to be clear about what that is. You know, what are the numbers? What's the profile of who's waiting? We need to be able to access, for example, through our Juvenile Directors Association. I'm assuming there are 36 of them.
Yes, ma'am.
36. That at least an email survey would reveal back to us what that population looks like on today, Wednesday, April 6, 2005. Anecdotally and in actual numbers.
I think that we could do a survey to say which young women do you have on parole or probation that could be referred to some level of residential care that either is not getting access. I mean, we can find out how many need it and how many openings there are. Would that
It's the need as well as the openings.
Okay.
And again, I'm honing in on your comment that there are these existing wait lists. So if that's the fact, then what is the information contained in the wait list?
Right.
That's what I'm trying
and,
to get.
And part of that is that Rosemont does have a short wait list, but the stay is fairly long, and so it just takes a certain number of kids on a wait list. There might be a lot more that should be on there. So in order to really get who should be on a wait list or who's waiting, I guess, is more than a wait list, I think we definitely get you who's waiting.
Yeah, again, the overarching issue is that we have an underserved population.
Yes.
That is girls. And they've been underserved in a number of categories over time. And our decisions need to be driven by good information, by data, and that's
what you need.
Mm-hmm.
We will. Okay, we can do that, Bob says, so we will do that.
Madam Chair, I would propose that we have our folks in the program office work with Ms. Patton's committee and the Juvenile Department Directors Association and perhaps look at framing it as we do the gap analysis, where we look at each individual case on a given day with a snapshot and identify what the need is and what the service availability to meet that need is.
Right, right. That will be very helpful, because it's one thing to talk about cutting, what we're cutting, and we know what that means in terms of diminishing services. But again, there is this other need out there.
Absolutely.
What does that look like? Okay.
Great.
Please continue.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a very legitimate question. And then the last one is the implementation, and that would be to establish an interim work group that would at specified times report to the Oregon Legislature on its recommendations and the agency's implementation of the recommendations, and that the group should include the participation and input by the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Access for Girls. Now, I need to add my comment on that last one, which is we really believe that this is a very positive first step, but that with an interim work group, we can't wait to be reporting back before we start some movement on this. We're going to lose too many young women if we wait. So I would definitely support the work group, but with and also reporting back to the legislature, but that I would hope that we would get the support of this committee to move ahead on the implementation process as quickly and as appropriately as we can, given the funding and given the situation that we're in.
Ms. Patton, in your thinking, who would establish the interim work group?
Well, I think that what we need is, actually we hadn't decided that it would be, we would definitely support the committee's recommendation on how they think that this interim group should be formed. I was assuming that OYA would set up the work group and support the work group, and that we would have participation on all relevant groups that would be influenced by this, so that we would again have a similar group to the one that we've had, but maybe not the same people, depending on their level of being able to really implement what we're talking about.
Mr. Jester, would you like to comment on that recommendation?
Madam Chair, I think that the work group that is currently in place and was a result of our advisory committee, the Youth Authority, would welcome the opportunity to continue the leadership in this area, not only working with the Equal Access for Young Women, but also with the Juvenile Department directors, providers, and other stakeholders and partners in either providing services for young women or that advocate for young women, if that would be the pleasure of the chair.
And so it sounds like that would be a continuation of work that has already been started, and not necessarily the creation of a brand new group to start all over again.
I think we may have to add a few different members, but I think that group could definitely lead that.
That sounds like a good way to move forward. Thank you very much for the presentation of the recommendations. Did you have further comments, Mr. Jester, on what has been presented?
Madam Chair, I would just like to go on the record of not only acknowledging the work that Ms. Patton has done, but I have been in this business for a long time, and Pam Patton has been an advocate for this underserved population in Oregon for a long time. And I think that it is our good fortune to have her working with us on this issue. And the recommendations, I think, are very thoughtful. The implementation of them will require some introspection in terms of how we allocate resource within the Youth Authority. And as I gave my commitment to Pam when she agreed to take on this task, that she would have the full support of the Youth Authority as they move through it. So I just really appreciate the fact that, that she's been willing to do this and continues it.
Yeah, she is a... You are a phenomenal woman, and I'm going to correct your language, Mr. Jester. You described Pam Patton as an advocate. I would describe her as a champion. There is a difference, and more power to you.
So much.
Keep doing what you do, and keep coming back to inform us about your efforts. This is very important work.
Thank you. Do you think it's this committee that we should be coming back to report, or...
I think that this committee certainly has a role, but I think that your work also has a place in the before the Human Services Committee, before the Education Committee. I mean, there are different intersections, and so we should continue to seek opportunities for you to share information and continue to educate the members as well. Most of our members don't know, don't have this information, don't understand that we have this challenge, which is trying to get services to an underserved population, a population that has been historically underserved.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, moving forward to the agency presentations, Mr. Jester, just forward those that you would like to join you as we move through the rest of the afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this time, I would like to have Brian Florup, who's our Assistant Director for Facility Services, join me at the table along with Ms. Gilbert Dess.
Okay, very good. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Florup. I am the Assistant Director at the Oregon Youth Authority responsible for facility operations. With Chair's permission, I would like to begin the Phase 2 part of the facilities presentation by briefly revisiting the agency's key measures of performance. And if that's acceptable, that section begins on page 50 of your presentation document. In Phase 1, and subsequent to the hearings, the committee provided feedback relating to the agency's performance measures, and in responding to that feedback, we have proposed the following changes to those performance measures. So if I might, I would start with the first three performance measures. We propose to reformat those. They report on various rates of activity in our facilities. We would like to reformat them to reflect number of occurrences rather than a rate. Performance measure 2, we would propose to change to report on injuries that are the result of either staff intervention or youth-on-youth inflicted injury, meaning we would drop away those accidental injuries resulting from recreation work activity, just kind of normal occurrence in a residential setting.
Why not include all of those categories?
Madam Chair, the current performance measure tracks all injuries. We also have the ability and do track injuries by distinct categories, the first being injuries caused by intervention from staff. We also track youth-on-youth assault kind of injuries, so we're able to report those to the committee or to the progress board. If you would turn to page 52, I'd like to take a moment and discuss changes to measures that more directly impact community protection and our agency's recidivism. For the next set of measures, we propose to refocus them to better reflect the agency's efforts to provide effective evidence-based programming to best protect the community by reducing recidivism. Performance Measure 5 has reflected intake screening completion in facilities, which is important to track, and we'll continue to do that. We propose, however, to redirect this measure to track and report the percentage of youth receiving a full risk need assessment at key points in their case. This identification of criminogenic risk and needs is key to developing effective case plans. This performance measure will be implemented agency-wide and tracked to individual locations for quality assurance purposes.
And, Mr. Floor, could you comment on what would be those different points?
Madam Chair, initially we would propose that the key points be at point of commitment to a facility program, so during the intake process, also at point of commitment to the agency for out-of-home services, whether that be probation or a community activity. We also believe it's important to reassess youth periodically, and that reassessment could be at points of transition when a youth is moving, say, from a facility to a community program.
There's a policy that guides when those key points take place.
Madam Chair, yes. We are just implementing or completing the implementation of the new risk need assessment, and currently our policy indicates that those should be completed at that first point of commitment, whether it be facility or probation, and also, again, as the case is nearing closure. We believe our practice will continue to evolve, and I think that points of transition are the natural points where we will identify that those needs, those youth need to be reassessed.
I understand. Ms. Baker?
Madam Chair, if I could clarify then. So instead of measuring it at one point in time at just intake, you would be broadening the measure. So it's looking not at just the initial screening, but as they're moving through the process, they're getting the risk needs assessments as they move through the process.
I'm sure, Ms. Baker, I think the key clarification there is the performance measure, as it's in the agency's presentation now, reflects a set of intake screenings, not the risk need assessment. And we'd like to convert that measure to reflect the risk need assessment. And it would be done during intake, but also at other points in the case life. Performance measure 6 will be enhanced to include the development of the case plan to address areas of risk and need identified in that comprehensive assessment. This performance measure would also be implemented agency-wide, and then we would track that to specific locations for quality assurance. So the key addition here would be not just to track that, in fact, a plan has been developed, but it's reflective of those needs and risks identified in the risk need assessment that we've just been speaking about. We further propose to combine performance measures 7 and 8 and refocus to tracking the development of transition plans for all youth that reflects supports and interventions addressing domain areas in their case plans that show a continuing need for activity. So I think when we talked in phase 1, there was concern about the single referral and just the development of a plan. Again, we'd like to refocus that performance measure to more specifically address areas in the case plan where there shows a continued need for our support to the youth or continuing intervention. We would further propose that we would add an additional performance measure that will be developed for community implementation that tracks the percentage of youth engaged in either school, work, or a combination of both within 30 days of release from a facility or residential setting. So that would be the implementation of that transition plan. We want to be able to track then at point of return to the community that, in fact, that youth is involved in a meaningful course of activities focused around school or vocation.
And that's 30 days?
Madam Chair, yes, that's our proposal, that would be the longest period of time that a youth would not be engaged in those kind of activities upon release. I think our goal is, of course, that they're engaged immediately when they return to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we would propose to include the two measures of recidivism discussed in the agency overview in our key performance measures reported to the legislature and to the Oregon Progress Board.
Excellent.
So with the committee's approval, we can begin immediately to implement the changes with input from both bodies as we do that.
I'm going to suggest that you do move forward, understanding that you'll be coming back to have that discussion and hopefully with a full complement of committee members.
That's
but we're on a good track. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. With that, I would like to direct the committee to page 55, where the Phase 2 section of the facilities presentation begins. And I would start with professional services and purchasing contracts, just to point out that in facilities we do purchase certain services and goods through contract with outside providers, and point out that it's nearly a third of our medical, pharmacy, and treatment services are in fact contracted out. And I'm sure some of those services we provide with OI staff, but there are some areas where we use contracts, and I think it depends kind of on resource available and whether we can recruit effectively in those rural locations.
Would you please provide a list of providers in the categories that are referenced here?
Madam Chair, we can do that. On the middle of page 55, you'll see a display of the quarterly vacancy report from December of 2004, and that reflects positions that have been vacant for 6 months prior to the reporting date in December.
6 months. Okay.
And on the bottom of page 55, what is displayed is some major budget issues that relate to facility operation. The first bullet there I would highlight speaks to the increased sentences of the youth that are under adult jurisdiction and how that impacts our operations and our lengths of stay. The second bullet speaks, of course, to the decline in our capacity, the reductions we took based on budget constraints. And you can see there's a chart there that kind of displays our average population over the years.
I'd like to go back to the vacancy report. The 15 detention positions, the result of having those vacancies for what period of time?
Madam Chair, those positions have been vacant for over 6 months, and they are in our budget to provide the ability for the agency to respond in the event that the county's operating detentions in Oak Creek and North Coast have issue and request our assistance. There are other fund positions. There's no general fund that supports those.
All right. That clarifies.
Turning to page 56, continuing the major budget issues, package 040, the mandated caseload growth as prescribed in the demand forecast, that's been discussed several times in the committee, so I won't dwell there unless there are questions. Package 090 is resource return to the general fund based on the Smart Buy initiative. It's projected savings in our telecommunications, office supplies, and other purchases that have been consolidated through DAS. Package 140, mental health and safety enhancements. Director Jester spoke about that. It's a self-finance position to convert several management positions and a recreation therapist to qualified mental health professionals to meet a demand at McLaren. And I believe that while self-financed, it does require an additional FTE to implement. On the middle of page 56 is the essential packages and the policy packages in the facility section of the budget. I would highlight package 021. That is the cost to biennialize the phased-in facilities at North Coast and at Oak Creek. And then you see package 040 was struck. That was the package that would have financed the demand forecast, and we just wanted to make sure that that was highlighted in our presentation. And if there are no questions, that completes phase two for facilities.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, at this time I'd like to ask Karen Olson, who is our Assistant Director for Business Services, to join me at the table, and she will take us through the capital budget section on phase two.
For the record, I'm Karen Olson, Assistant Director of Business Services with the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'll be starting on page 58 today to talk about capital improvement budgets and debt service. As I mentioned during our phase one testimony, we do have a four-year capital improvement management plan that has 27 projects totaling over $1 million. In the 2005-07 budget, we have $630,815 to accomplish as many of those projects as we can. The only change in this budget from the current biennium is a small amount of inflation that was added. On page 59, I think we've talked before, and I know Linda Gilbert also talked about our debt service. I think the good news there is our debt service is down by $4 million. That's due to paying off some certificates of participation that we had to make improvements in our facilities and to build the juvenile justice information system, and also due to the transfer of our Ochoco property to the Department of Administrative Services. So we're left with $6.6 million to repay certificates of participation that were connected to the building of the four regional facilities that we have. And on page 60, you can just see at the top is the building of the capital improvement budget with the essential packages. Debt service is not built the same way. It is a figure that changes each biennium based on the amount that DAS estimates we'll need to repay. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
No questions, but just thank you, Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to call your attention back in the appendices under number 2 for those that are interested in what the rest of the repayment schedule looks like for the outstanding debt. There is a table there that provides that information, so you can look at the long-term balances that are going to be due for the agency.
Thank you again.
Madam Chair, at this time I'd like to ask Robin Cole to join me at the table, who will discuss our community and program services. And as you may recall from phase one, she is the Assistant Director for Field Services for the Authority.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, Robin Cole, Assistant Director for Field Operations with the Oregon Youth Authority, and I will be presenting Phase 2 of Community and Program Services. I would like to start with asking you to direct your attention to the chart here on my left and on your right. It outlines or illustrates the Community Program Services budget and how we expend our funds. $99.5 million in total funds, $71.8 general funds. And I was struck listening to the public testimony yesterday that through phase one, my goal was to share with you how we are woven into our local communities and how we coordinate our services with our local partners, with families and staff, and certainly try to integrate within local communities. And as testimonies came through yesterday, it was evident, I think, that our funding base and our coordination is certainly there in the community, and we are a part of our communities. And so as I go through the different sections, I hope to bring forward how some of the faces that you saw yesterday in the testimony you saw yesterday fit into some of these categories. Approximately 70% of our budget is contracted through intergovernmental agreements or professional services agreements. So I would point out, to start with, residential services and foster care are about 51% of our budget. And as Gary Hansen was here yesterday from Bologna's representing residential program, and Molly Rogers spoke to the addition of some resource for sex offenders in rural and frontier communities, that would be representative of some of our work in the residential arena there, and 51% of our budget. Parole and probation services and individualized services represents 27% of our budget. Yesterday we heard from Reverend Rob Richardson, who represents part of the services there in terms of individualized services expenditures. Juvenile crime prevention, diversion, and gang represents 17% of our budget. And we heard yesterday from four juvenile department directors Specifically, Joanne Fuller from Multnomah County spoke to the game services and the effects of the kinds of services that they've put in place in Multnomah County to have a direct impact on youth that have been associated with the gang elements in the community and the strides that they have made there. Additionally, we have 5% of our budget that is directly associated with our program office that I shared in phase one with you around evaluation and policy and treatment services. We have about 600 contracts with over 300 providers that surround therapy services, residential and independent living services, so there's just a number of providers that we work with across the state and in the community, and I wanted to highlight that and put a name or a category to some of the faces that you saw. In terms of major budget issues, I'd like to highlight Package 040, which speaks to the mandated caseload, and these are community services that are associated with the close custody demand forecast, which was eliminated in the governor's recommended budget. Package 090, analyst recommended adjustments, the youth gang services reduction by 22%, and then the Smart Buy initiative, which has been covered here previously. And package 230, which is the Clackamas office relocation. We have a Clackamas parole and probation office out in Oregon City that has had a challenging time meeting safety, health, and American with Disabilities Act requirements, and so we're asking for some one-time funds to assist in the relocation of that office. Page 75 speaks to the essential packages, and I would like to highlight just a few of those for you. Package 021, as Mr. Florup spoke to, is the roll-up of the 50-bed facilities, the North Coast and Eastern facilities. They're associated community services, specifically some residential beds, parole and probation services, and individualized services that are associated with that that move into 0507. And then package 040 around the mandated caseload, as you can see, that has been eliminated based on the governor's recommended budget. So unless there are any other questions or any questions, that would conclude my presentation.
Ms. Zucker? Madam Chair and Ms. Cole, yesterday during the testimony, Patricia Chamberlain testified about the multidimensional treatment foster care. And my question is, can you talk a little bit about how moving to that model affects or doesn't affect the budget and the capacity in the community?
Certainly, I'll try to answer both of those questions. First, of course, it's an evidence-based model, and we have been working closely with and contracting for, by the way, in terms of some capacity with the Oregon Social Learning Center. It is a model where you place one youth in a home. And so in terms of the impact to the budget, it is a more costly model, and it's certainly evidence-based, and so we do find that there are better outcomes and better successes in terms of the profile of the youth that is placed in the home and then the eventual outcome for success. So I think hopefully that answers one of your questions in terms of the fiscal impact. Again, we have provided a baseline for them in working with them around developing the model. And question two was?
Well, the first question was in terms of how. Maybe let me rephrase what I'm trying to get to.
Okay.
I think her proposal was eliminate foster care generally and move to this model. And so on a one-to-one basis, I know that the agency's been moving in that direction and using this model. But then what does the budget anticipate in terms of continuing that movement and getting to that as opposed to the regular foster care?
I believe that certainly the agency is moving in that direction for part of the population. I think that the solution for the recommendation for treatment foster care serves part of a profile of youth, but it may not be the complete answer for all of the youth in foster care. For instance, I would give the example that Molly Rogers and Joyce Armstead brought up, where they talked about assessment centers. That may be part of the answer as well, in terms of shorter-term assessment programs that are part of the need for the population, where there is an interim stay prior to a placement. There may be different pieces of placement options for youth. Certainly, the residential or the multidimensional treatment foster care model is in fact one based on evidence that is successful with a profile of youth that we have moved toward and endorsed and want to continue to work with OSLC across the state. We have attempted to replicate that in the Portland area, working with Patty and her team in providing an oversight in the development or the implementation of additional resource there.
Has it worked, the attempted replication?
We've struggled with that, Madam Chair. We've struggled with it.
I'd like to know more about that, what that means, what struggle means. It seems to me the reality is that, you know, we're moving toward evidence-based practices, but we haven't had enough practice on the ground to see if it's really going to work. You follow what I'm saying? So I just want us to keep that reality in front of us as well. Evidence-based practices has become a mantra, but until we actually have something that we can unpack, look at, and say, and this is how it really works in our communities, then we have a ways to go. So again, I'd like to know more about what's happening in Multnomah County, and as that experience unfolds, what are we learning?
Mm-hmm.
For the investment, what are we learning?
Would you, Madam Chair, would you like a follow-up narrative provided?
A follow-up narrative would be just fine.
Right.
Just fine.
Madam Chair, for the record, Bob Jester again. I absolutely agree with you that we have not fully explored the evidence-based programs and their implementation in the state of Oregon. I think one thing that we do know, and one thing that the counties have been out in front of us on, and that is the individual risk need assessment as a starting point for determining what a person that enters a juvenile justice system needs in regard to case planning and where those needs can best be met.
Yes.
And one of the charges that Ms. Cole has taken on is looking specifically at the youth that we currently have in family foster care, and through the risk need assessment and the individual case plan, what, as we talked with the young women, what is the appropriate level of service that those young people should be receiving? And I think the one that the assessment centers, they're also a shelter. And many times what we find is there is a youth in crisis, and they've either run away from another placement, perhaps their home, and we need to put them somewhere. And they've been picked up or they've turned themselves in, and we now have to put them someplace to spend that first night. And in the absence of shelter care and in the absence of that youth being detained, many of those youth go into foster care, which is not necessarily the right level of service or care for that youth at that time. And through our internal audit that we have just concluded of foster care, I think we will get additional information to share with this committee in terms of how that looks with the youth that are currently being served at that level.
And we did establish in the earlier hearing that, you know, you need a time frame before we can actually get to talking about performance measures. Some actual experience. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, at this time I'd like to call Ms. Olson back to the table to talk about our administration.
Again, I'm Karen Olson, the Assistant Director of Business Services with the Oregon Youth Authority. I'll be starting on page 81, just briefly reviewing the Phase 2 material for administration. At the top of page 81, you see a chart that shows that administration is 6% of the budget, and agency-wide costs, which are included in the administration budget, are another 3%. And if you remember from Phase 1, the functions that are included in administration are the director's office, business services, agency-wide costs, and the statewide support for the juvenile justice information system. In Phase 1, Representative Hansen asked a question about the, sort of the cost split on JGIS, and I've got a chart map here. This is our house graphic. And on the left-hand side of the page, you notice the county costs. That's sort of the juvenile department house. And they pay for their own computers, printers, their local network, the time of their staff for participating in the Juvenile Justice Information System Steering Committee, on-the-job training, those types of things. But on the right-hand side, you see the costs that OIA and the state bear, and that includes paying for all of the telephone lines that transmit the data, developing and maintaining JGIS, storing the database and processing that on a Department of Administrative Services computer, all the licenses that we have for types of software. And we provide a statewide help desk and statewide training for the 37 members of the JGIS partnership. I think in terms of any major budget drivers, on page 81, clearly the major driver for administration is the level of program that we provide. Secondly, in the past, the development of JGIS was a cost driver. That's now been stabilized. Third, as I'll talk about in just a minute, changes in those agency-wide costs have been a budget driver. And then in some cases, we have made decisions to do less based on having to reduce administrative costs because of fiscal considerations. On page 82, I'll talk about our use of contracting. In administration, we have used professional services contracts in the development of JGIS, and we have a couple of contractors that we can use a work order system to purchase various types of services in development and maintenance of the system. In terms of vacancies, the latest quarterly vacancy report had one vacancy in December of 2004, which has since been filled. I'm going to take this opportunity while talking about administration to review the other fund balances across the entire budget. And on page 82, we're projecting other funds ending balances of $205,000. $65,000 are necessary to provide working capital for the youth work programs that I think you heard speakers talk about yesterday. We provide programs either through the Department of Education, but then we also have our own work opportunities. We have our own businesses, and we need working capital to keep those going at the beginning of each biennium. And then secondly, we're projecting an ending balance of $140,000, which is funding from SAFE's Employer at Injury Program. That's a program which provides funding for transitional opportunities for individuals who've been injured at work, and then we bring them back in a modified type of work environment. We get wage subsidies from SAFE. We also get some training monies, and we get some work site modifications. We use this funding not only for the transition of the employee, but also we use some of it centrally to provide the opportunity
to train individuals, particularly on our safety committees, in safety issues and in those issues that correspond to how to return injured employees to work as quickly as possible. On page 83, we have a chart at the top which shows the essential packages. I'd like to talk about one package in particular, which is package 030. You see there's about an $800,000 to $900,000 increase in that package. That package contains a small amount of inflation on services and supplies, but the largest amount of that is increases in state government service charges, particularly payments to the risk management division. In 2005 to 07 will be the first time that state agencies have paid a full workers' compensation premium for a number of biennia, and so workers' compensation costs have increased. However, all other insurances like property, auto, and liability for the Oregon Youth Authority have decreased. So we are making efforts to hold those costs down, but because in workers' compensation, reserves that were available in former biennia are not available in 05-07. We do have quite an increase there. And I think that completes what I have to say, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Ms. Baker, any comments?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, at this time I'd like to ask Phil Lemon, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, to join me. And I would like to do a couple of things with your permission. One is to respond to a request made on Monday that we provide a copy of the Multnomah County Gang Services report to the Emergency Board, which we have for committee members, as well as we were asked to bring a report on the distribution of the one-time gang funds that were allocated by the Emergency Board to counties to be used through the remainder of this biennium. And we had a request from the chair to provide a document and talk about the Oregon Youth Authority's external review process related to the Boyles case. I believe that Ms. Baker is handing out the gang document as well as the emergency board. And finally, Madam Chair, we have the report on our our external review process, which we would be happy to either answer questions on or go through for the record, whichever would be the Chair's pleasure.
Please go through it for the record, and that, I'm hoping that also includes a response to the question concern raised when we were off the record by Representative Hannah at our last meeting, and also raised again by myself, the letter that both of us received that we needed you to respond to on the record.
Madam Chair, yes, it does, and I'm going to ask Mr. Lemon to walk us through that, and both of us would be happy to answer any questions the Chair may have.
Is there a copy of what you're going to be walking through?
Ms. Baker has distributed to you. It's Madam Chair, Phil Lemon, Deputy Director of the Youth Authority. It's called Youth Safety and Abuse Prevention Review Committee.
Right.
We've spent a substantial amount of time in this committee talking about this issue and the agency's response to it. Earlier this week, some concerns were raised, both, I think, to get some more specific information about the direction the agency was heading and also to address some concerns about the independence of this committee and its ability to thoroughly and candidly review and make recommendations to the agency and other interested parties. So in response to that, I've at the top you will see review committee members. For those members, we talked to them and they agreed to for those who have agreed to serve and agreed to have their names released at this time, you have those there. I've also, number 6, 7, and 8, those positions, we either do not have a specific individual or do not have their specific consent to discuss their names at this time. But very briefly, the first name on the list is Rod Brown. Again, he is the retired McMinnville police chief and currently a law enforcement consultant. He has a firm that conducts both internal reviews on specific incidents in public safety agencies. If there's an allegation that a police officer, for example, has acted improperly, he will go in and conduct a specific review on that. He also does a larger scale policy and management review, such as he just participated in with Eugene Police Department, where they ended up having two police officers convicted of felony sex abuse charges in relation to their official duties. And so he has a substantial amount of experience in this area, and he will be serving as the committee chair, the facilitator, and convener for this process. And again, at some point, if the we are still drafting the scope of work for his service with the Youth Authority, we plan to have in that he would appear. We would plan to have the committee prepare either preliminary or final recommendations by June 1 to present to this committee and give to legislative leadership, and it would be our intention to have Mr. Brown present those so you hear it straight from the group that conducted the review and presented the recommendations to you. The second name on the list is Bob Jundeff. Mr. Jundeff is the executive director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. That is a nonprofit in Oregon that provides legal advocacy for persons with disabilities, which includes mental illness. As I think we've discussed here, most of the youth on Mr. Boyle's caseload had mental health issues, and Mr. Jundeff and his organization advocates and ensures that their civil rights are protected. In that capacity, he's also served on a previous OIA external review panel. So he is someone who has, again, come in and assisted us in an outside look at our policies and practices and has, I think, the degree of independence and duties that you would expect us to have in this process. Third name on the list is Heidi Meyer. She is a juvenile parole and probation officer with the Oregon Youth Authority. She's out of our Umatilla office. She will be representing both the juvenile justice and the perspective of a working parole and probation officer.
Is she a union member?
Madam Chair, yes, she is.
Please continue.
Fourth name is Helen Smith. She is a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. She supervises the unit in that office that prosecutes sex offenses against children. She has knowledge of this specific case, and we have, I think as Mr. Jester has discussed with this committee previously, we have sought their input and feedback on an informal basis about lessons learned and what we need to be doing to prevent this from happening again, but this will provide formal representation from that office in this process. To make things a little more confusing, we add another Ms. Smith to the panel. That is Lisa Smith. She is the Lane County Juvenile Department Director. She is fairly new to Oregon, but brings a substantial expertise in best practices and in working with sex offenders, both of which we think are important qualities to have in this group. Next is the Juvenile Rights Project. We do not have a specific representative identified, but as I think members of this committee know, the general role of the Juvenile Rights Project is to provide legal services to youth offenders and other children. They do a lot of policy level and legislative work to advocate to make sure that the rights of children are protected and resolve system issues involving those youth and children. Number 7 is a juvenile court judge. We do have a commitment from a senior juvenile court judge. I was not able to get his consent to release his name at this time, but I do think we have that position filled on the committee. The other one that we wanted to add is a court-appointed special advocate. These CASAs are volunteers who are trained and appointed by the court to represent abused or neglected children in court proceedings. They investigate information relevant to a specific child's case. They are in place to represent the best interest of the child, ensure that agencies meet their obligations, and monitor compliance with court orders. And I think that description of that role is something that we are interested in having. Those are similar functions that we want this panel to do. We want them to look at the relevant information, make sure that the youth's interests are being represented in this, that we are meeting our obligations and doing what we are supposed to do in this process. We do not have a specific person lined up for that and are soliciting names to add to this group.
Looking at the committee member, the third member, Ms. Meyer, how long has she been an employee of the Oregon Youth Authority?
Madam Chair, I'm not able to answer that at this time. I can get back to you on that.
Has she at any time met or trained with, been associated with Mr. Boyles? Would there ever have been an opportunity for their
pass across? Madam Chair, I don't believe so. Mr. Boyles...
Has that question been asked?
I have not asked that question ever.
It needs to be asked.
I will do that.
Continue.
In addition to those people whose service we have asked for on this committee, we have also arranged for other individuals to serve as resources where there are specific issues or questions that they provide individual expertise on. And they have agreed to be on call at the service and request of this committee to provide information. First on the list is Corey Jewel Jensen. She is a sex offender therapist in Beaverton. She has done a lot of work both on the juvenile justice and in the adult side in working with public safety agencies on effective treatment practices for sex offenders, but more importantly for this role, she trains public safety agencies and community groups on how to identify sex offenders, what grooming behaviors they utilize, and then how to identify and prevent those from coming to fruition. Lindsey Hayes is in the National Center for Alternatives to Institutionalization. He is an expert on preventing suicides in closed custody in facilities, not just closed custody, corrections institutions. And he has chaired the two previous review committees for the Oregon Youth Authority, knows the process, I think has a very good sense of the independence that's necessary in this, and will, again, be able to serve in an advisory capacity to the group. Timothy Travis is with the Oregon Judicial Department. He is going to be conducting some of the training that the Director Jester has ordered, that each OIA employee receive a refresher training on their obligations under the Mandatory Abuse Reporting Statute. He testified, I believe, 2 weeks ago in Senate Judiciary about that. At the specific request of Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, and they are very supportive of his efforts, and we very much appreciate Mr. Travis making himself available to both to do the training and to assist in this larger overview. The last name on the list is Annabelle Jaramillo. Ms. Jaramillo is now an elected Benton County Commissioner, but she was the Governor's Citizens Representative in a previous administration, and as I think you know in that role, they take the complaints and information, concerns about state agencies that are sent to the Governor and make sure they are followed up in an appropriate manner, and will have, I think, a good perspective on that issue to assist the committee in looking at different models to make sure that we are in both encouraging information coming forward and have an appropriate process to deal with those once they do come in. The next concern was just general information about what the committee's charge would be. The punchline is that we are opening the doors to this committee to look at what they think they need to look at in order to make recommendations to the Oregon Youth Authority and to the legislature. We will be providing them information on what we already have done to address this case, the changes in policies, practices, procedures, rules, etc. But also, we want them to come in and give us a thorough and candid review of what else we have not yet done or have not finalized, and get an outside look at what we need to be doing to ensure to the highest level of probability that this will not happen again. And so the charge is based again, to give them that open door and to ask them to do what they think they need to do to conduct that review and give us the recommendations. Specifically, it's, I think the first paragraph, again, is self-explanatory. Secondly, we want to make sure that we have an environment as well as policies and procedures that encourage reporting of suspected abuse by anyone, whether that's a youth offender, their family, OYA staff, or other persons, and make sure that we have both the, again, the environment as well as the policies and procedures in place to appropriately follow up on those that information once we receive it. The next item was in partial response to Representative Wisnant's concerns about the independence of this committee and its relationship with the Youth Authority. As we've discussed, we want to make sure that this committee, as well as other legislators, have a report in place by June 1 that shows the work of this committee, what their thoughts are, what they see as the gaps, if any, and get their recommendations to not only our agency so we can act on them, but to you as our board of directors so you can have the assurance that you need that we are following up appropriately. In order to do that, we will have a report to you no later than June 1. If the committee's work is done by that time, you'll have a final report. If it's not done at that time, you will have the preliminary recommendations and also a work plan and timeline so you know exactly what the steps are left to complete that work. And at the request of Representative Wisnant, that, again, that report will go directly to legislative leadership as well as to the agency, so you have direct access to that.
It should also come to this committee. This is the only committee that has held hearings on the subject matter.
I just assumed that that would happen, Madam Chair, but I'd be glad to make that specific in here.
Should be named.
We will do that. Then, in addition, in order to make sure that some of the questions, especially presented by Senator Winters and others that we have visited with in this building, to make sure that those are addressed, I do have 9 other issues that we want specific consideration and follow-up on. First is what kind of mechanism should the agency use to log abuse-related complaints and information to make sure that we identify what information came in, where it came in, and what the follow-up and disposition was. One of the questions that has come up is information has come in, there's no documented follow-up, and we want to make sure we have a system in place where we can provide that information to you. Second is more a structural question in terms of how the agency is organized to respond to these types of complaints. Do we have an adequate system now to do that, or should we have a designated ombudsman or internal review process, or inspector general whose function it specifically is to investigate these kind of issues, to, again, with the end goal of ensuring that these complaints get appropriate attention and response. And so we will have information on a variety of models, and we'll ask the committee to review those and make a recommendation on the structure that they feel is most appropriate. Third question is looking at the agency training policies and procedures on reporting suspected abuse, whether that rises to the level of a mandatory abuse report or whether it's information that does not meet that level. But again, we want to make sure that we are encouraging that information to come forward in the agency and that we have an appropriate follow-up, even if we're not legally required to report that to either Child Protective Services or a law enforcement agency. So we will ask them to look not just at that legal threshold, but all that kind of information that may come in. Number 4 is an organizational question. Are there changes in agency management structure, chains of command, supervision, those type of issues that, again, ensure appropriate checks and balances that might prevent potential abuse situations? Number 5 is you've heard and expressed the concern about an agency. Excuse me.
I want to go back to number 3 before I lose my thought. Sorry to interrupt your train of thought. But there should be, we need to look at how whistleblower complaints are handled as well. And I don't know how you've talked about that or if you are including that in your 3.
Madam Chair, we had not specifically contemplated that, but we'll add that as a specific charge to the committee to make sure that they look at, speaking personally, my thinking was that information on suspected abuse in this particular case came from family members in the first instance, and then, as we will discuss in a moment, from other people who have either information or concerns about how the agency has or has not responded to information that has come in.
I would consider the letter, for example, that I shared with Mr. Jester, and the letter that Representative Hannah shared, which is the same letter, an example of what I mean by whistleblower complaint. This is a person, anonymous, making allegations about the how the complaints were handled. So it's in the whistleblower category.
Madam Chair, I agree. Yes. We want to make sure that we have an accepting and welcoming environment to make sure that any information of concern of suspected abuse gets addressed, gets presented to the agency, and gets addressed appropriately. And I think, if I understand correctly, that it would include staff. It would include making sure that any concerns about possible retaliation are addressed, but also that we are not going to ignore complaints and make sure that there is an appropriate follow-up. So when I say welcoming environment, appropriate follow-up, I'm trying to cover that. We will specifically include those types of complaints in there.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
In that same area, if the wording was just a little bit broader, it could also cover like any other type of criminality that I don't think you'd want, if misappropriation of public dollars or theft or criminal actions outside of.
Yes.
And you might as well have the same procedures in place.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I agree entirely. We would, I think, ask that the committee focus on the abuse issues.
Clearly,
that's important. But if they have other thoughts, again, we certainly don't want to close the door on those issues. So we will add that as a clarification.
Good.
I believe I was finishing with number 5, again, to make sure that we have recommendations to ensure that the agency has appropriate policies and expectations in place to encourage the reporting of suspected abuse of youth offenders and assure appropriate follow-up, and we've discussed some clarifications and changes to that, so we will incorporate those.
This is question or the issue that goes to what you raised, Representative Hansen, the first part of number 5, reviewing concerns regarding agency culture. You were very emphatic. I think we all were, that this is something that needs to be addressed. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, a companion piece to the specific question that we are going to ask this outside external review committee to look at, we also are accessing a master contract through Department of Administrative Services through Peggy Ross's shop, and that is for a cultural climate assessment and survey and follow-up training at all the work sites of OYA, and that is being done by Francis Portillo, who is a private vendor, and DAS has recently secured a contract with her organization, and she will actually start that process for the Youth Authority at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility and then move through the organization looking at these issues as well as the charge to this committee.
And continuing on, Madam Chair, number 6 is develop recommendations for an OIA review process following abuse-related incidents. We have a process in place for injuries to youth in our custody and care. There are a couple other agency models that we would present to the committee to make sure that they have a range of options and ensure that we have appropriate follow-up. One would be the critical incident response system used by Department of Human Services. We've also worked with the State Risk Management Division, and they have what we call a four-quadrant model that, again, are just different methods of reviewing and analyzing what happened in a particular incident, and again, with the goal of ensuring that it does not happen again, that we have a process in place to learn from any mistakes we have made and remedy those.
Is there a link between the existing critical incident response team and the governor's office?
Madam Chair, the critical incident response team was developed as a result of a directive from the governor's office to DHS and the youth authority to look at changes that we thought we needed to make to ensure there was a follow-up for incidents of this nature. Many of the, when we reported back to the governor, it included many of the policy changes and rule changes that we already have made in response to this case. DHS was in response to some different incidents, but yes, short answer is yes.
Is a member of the governor's staff on the response team?
Madam Chair, I do not know the answer to that. I believe it's an internal agency process that gets reported to the governor's office, but I can confirm that for you.
Okay. I'd like to know what that chain of reporting looks like. What would be, for example, what would be the earliest notification to the governor's office that there is a critical incident, and who would make that report, and what did that look like in this situation, the situation that will be under review?
Okay. Number seven again is a lessons learned. Don't necessarily reinvent the wheel. There have been recommendations from reviews from other agency reports, including reviews of the Oregon State Hospital, the Eugene Police Department, the Oregon Youth Authority reviews of deaths and youth in custody. And so to the extent we can build on what others have already done, we would like to do that. The number eight is, again, as the chair has mentioned, members of this subcommittee received an anonymous letter dated March 15, 2005, that raised some concerns and questions about the Boyles matter. And so we will be presenting that to the committee and asking them to do a review and, again, make an appropriate response to the agency. And then number nine, again, is the open door. We're not trying to, these are examples of specific things we want them to address. If they see other needs, other issues, we want them to feel free to raise those to us so, again, we can have a full discussion on issues that they have identified in this process.
Great. Comments or questions? Representative Hansen, Senator Devlin. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you want me to go through either of the gang funding reports that you requested, or is that?
I'm familiar with the reports. I think other members wanted to see them. Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in wrapping up, I would like to say that both through Phase 1 and Phase 2, I hope that the committee has benefited from the presentation of the interdependency and the links across the continuum of the juvenile justice system, the Oregon Youth Authority being one piece of that continuum, but not the entire continuum. And I cannot stress enough the partnerships that we have with communities and the interdependence on the empowerment of those communities to provide services on the front end, both prevention and through their probation departments. They receive funding from the Youth Authority, as you heard, through both the County Diversion, the JCP Basic, and the Juvenile Crime Prevention dollars. And those are essential funds to head off what otherwise would be an increase in commitments to state-level services at the Youth Authority, DHS, and an additional burden
potentially on other departments and agencies in the state. I think we have been very successful as a result of Senate Bill 1 to design a system in Oregon that is a model. I think that unfortunately that system was never fully funded. We have never benefited from the vision of the residential academies. We have never benefited from the empowerment of communities through both county work and through private agencies on that community side. And most recently, we have seen the decreased amount of discretionary beds that have been made available to counties to provide that secure placement for youth offenders while we get them grounded and get them working on their reformation issues and then be able to return to their communities and continue that work. The Youth Authority has not been funded in the past and is not recommended to be funded at this time to the level that the demand forecast indicates is necessary to carry out the mission of public safety in juvenile justice in the state. I was heartened by hearing from those that testified yesterday in the public hearing. I think they touched on every piece of that continuum, both as agency representatives from the private sector, county governments, individual recipients of those services, and volunteers. And it is a combination of efforts that I believe have resulted in a 10-year consistent decline in the recidivism of youth offenders in the state of Oregon, and it is a model and is an outcome that this state should be proud of. I think we can do better. I think that we strive to do better, and there is a linkage between outcomes and the level of resource. I was reviewing the four charges that this committee made in terms of their prioritizations, and I hope that we have presented our materials to this committee emphasizing that Oregonians have the right to be safe and talking about the reduction of recidivism, the reduction in new crimes that youth in the juvenile justice system, both at the county level and the state level, have done over a 10-year period of time. That state government should be stable and responsive and accountable to Oregonians and work cooperatively and in a coordinated manner with the private sector and other levels of government. And the responsiveness to the system is essential to its credibility. I am sorry that the Boyles incident has overshadowed in part the presentation before this committee. I think of the relationship between the Youth Authority and county governments, private providers as reflected through our co-management agreements, and the connectivity that we have in Oregon to produce the outcomes that have been produced. I believe that everyone, to use the chair's word and correction of me earlier, these are not advocates for youth and for juvenile justice. These are really champions that are involved in the delivery of these services. Access to justice for all. At each point across the continuum, we have identified how to best provide equal access to both gender and ethnicity, both rural and in the valley. And we reported that both through our work with the Disproportionate Minority Confinement Report by Mr. Jackson, as well as our recent agency affirmative action report on accomplishments for the past biennium, which was submitted to the governor's office. Your fourth priority, the priorities of Oregonians should be respected to the diversity of our state. Again, I would remind the committee of the partnership that the Youth Authority has had with the Coalition of Eastern and Central Oregon County Juvenile Justice Model, which we have maintained for a decade now, and trying to close that urban and rural and frontier county divide
as well as the attention that we have tried to pay as a juvenile justice system, not just through the Youth Authority, but through our partners and stakeholders, to the goals of affirmative action and equal access. I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have about our presentation or materials.
Mr. Jester, I thank you very much for framing your closing comments around the committee's four principles. We appreciate that very much, having worked very hard to arrive at those principles. One of the statements or some of the testimony that stays with me from yesterday came from the first gentleman who testified, and I'm sorry I cannot recall his name now, but he's one of your employees and lives here in the Salem area. He was the gentleman who also spoke about how he'd been a recent crime victim himself due to methamphetamine. The importance of young people making restitution to their victims, that also came through in the testimony yesterday. That, I guess, just underscoring that part of the accountability of our overall system. Certainly, the testimony that we heard underscored the importance and value of the system that we have, but you have also pointed out that the system we have has never been fully invested in, and that will be a remaining challenge for this legislature. I want to thank you for your hard work and all of those who support your leadership in the agency. I appreciate the professionalism that's been on display here, and we look forward to having you back. And again, thank the members for being part of this discussion. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add, Ms. Gilbert? Okay. All right. Well, with that said, and I believe that we've concluded our business for the day.
Thank you, Madam Chair.